So we're going to start talking about generic qubits. And how to learn about them, how to control them, and then how to place them into some system, which hopefully become a quantum processor, and what do we need to do that. And today, I just want to start with the general scheme of what and how, and then we'll go on and look at a quantum processor starting tomorrow. Most of the ideas of qubits, of course, end up being taken from the first time that one had a qubit. And that's in the molecular beam experiments, actually atomic beam experiments. So it's early versions of looking at nuclear spins, where instead of having a sample in a bulk, you would send a beam of atoms. And we're not going to talk about that. But the language in describing the experiments comes from those experiences. And then that language is spread throughout the community. So the first thing we want about a qubit is a two-level system. And so therefore it has to have a quantization axis. There needs to be an energy cost of changing its states. Otherwise, we wouldn't have two levels. And it's conventional to put that energy axis, the quantization axis, along Z. Now, of course, this means something. It says, oh, I know how to do that. And so for some qubits, we'll find that there's an error with how precisely we can identify that quantization axis. But for now, let's just leave it there and say, okay, so we have a quantization axis and we've arbitrarily set it to be along Z, and that since we have one qubit, this is the internal Hamiltonian. And the internal Hamiltonian typically means that it's always there. Because if I have an energy cost at zero, then everything in the universe is big, right? So it turns out, think about your energy splitting. If I have an energy splitting, then it's only those Hamiltonians that commute with that which are going to shift it. And so you've thrown away almost all Hamiltonians in the universe already. Whereas if I say, oh, no, I want this to be zero, then it becomes a very hard to control device. And so we can pretend occasionally that it is. But it's just really a pretend idea. It's not one that's there. It's also, remember that there's no particular value to having the energy cost zero in the frame that we walk around. Because we can always go to an interaction frame where the energy cost is zero. And so that's going to be a more useful approach. You have an example? Right, no one else does either.
Could you repeat?
It was, what about topological protection? So if I have my Mariana, why would I want this? And, it's a conversation for another day, but of course there have been experiments that have looked closely at systems that are supposed to have that. And unfortunately, what we find is a lot of noise. So that, you know, the idea that the dominant physics are going to reveal those structures so far hasn't been the case. But we're gonna start much more pedestrian than that. Okay, so we've got this piece, and of course we would like to control the system. And for controlling the system, we have a few simple handles. We could say that we're going to vary H internal. And I could do that adiabatically or diabatically. Of course, what I would need to do is to vary the Hamiltonian in a way that doesn't commute with this, right? Because the action is always going to become as a non-commutivity of those. And so it's not that I would want to change this frequency. So I want to change that axis. Okay, and we can, of course, get control that way. And occasionally we do. But it's much more common to get control by a resonant drive. So to get control in an interaction frame. And the reason for that is it's pretty simple. That if I want to change if I want to get control by changing the internal Hamiltonian, then I need to apply energy that's of order the internal Hamiltonian. Whereas here, I can get the same amount of control for a much lower energy cost. And since we're worried about heating up and controlling our qubits, this we can make more precise than that. And so we're going to introduce a control Hamiltonian. That is time dependent and orthogonal to this. And of course, you've seen in many other places that if I have a Hamiltonian, then the spin is going to precess. And it's going to precess at a frequency given by this about the z direction. And so the resonant piece here says that we're going to periodically modulate this. So it's just so that whereas the spin processes, we're always rotating it the same way when it reaches the same position on the Bloch sphere. Okay? And it seems a little bit awkward to include this cosine term. But experimentally, in virtually every system, that's what we do. Because one, it doesn't cost us anything to only have the cosine term. And it costs us in hardware if I want to build in a sine and a cosine term. So if I take this piece, then the first piece that we think about is decomposing into a rotating and counter-rotating field. So, if you recall, And if I write down the same thing, just changing the sign, if I add those, I get twice the cosine piece. And so, correctly, I can say, yes, if I'm thinking about a cosine modulation, if I want a modulation along this axis of cosine, if I have a modulation, that's a phase modulation, and I sum the two of them together, and I get exactly that. And that, of course, you also see in your transistor radios that none of you have anymore, that that we can take an amplitude modulation, we can convert it into a sum of frequency modulations. Okay. So we remind ourselves how the density matrix evolves via the Liouville von Neumann equation. And what I want to do is I want to move rho into an interaction frame. Because I don't really care about that internal Hamiltonian, okay? I'd like to just show that in this reference frame, we have the control that we need. And of course, it's straightforward to do. I need to choose what I want for the interaction frame. But of course, the interaction frame I want is I want this control piece. I want one of those to be time independent. Okay, so we're going to choose U. You know, I should have to look because otherwise I'll get my sign wrong. And of course, the derivative of the unitary is just going to return I times the Hamiltonian. So we can write down the Hamiltonian for that. Yeah, perfect. And we stick everything in. This, of course, we know. Here, we get the term. Now, of course, the derivative of the unitary and the unitary commute with each other. So I'll write it as that. And let's call this H sub R, because it's the Hamiltonian that's taking us into the rotating frame. And of course, we'll see a similar thing here that we can take And of course, every time we see this, we can replace that with U tilde. And I've left out the unitary here, which is not so nice. And so here, we're converting all of this into the interaction frame. And of course, we have the same thing there. And so d rho tilde dt is equal to where this is the total Hamiltonian. In the rotating frame. Now, of course, the Hamiltonian, the rotating frame, well, it involves the internal and the control piece. And the internal Hamiltonian commutes with our transformation into the rotating frame, right? The internal Hamiltonian was long z, and our rotations are about z. And so the only piece we need to worry about is these rotating and counter-rotating fields. And so we say, oh yes, this piece here is equal to the internal Hamiltonian plus is equal to and there's a frequency in front of these, right? And so the frequency is going to be omega RF, I think I called it. Yeah. Omega RF divided by 2, divided by 4. I get another factor of 2 because of that factor of 2 there. And I'm going to take this whole thing and sandwich it by those unitaries. So again, this one just remains. Here, I get a mess, but look here. Then, of course, the unitaries cancel out, and I get just sigma x, so I get a term that is omega RF over 4 sigma x, plus I get the term which is this piece. And so this term, well, if u is equal to e to the I omega t t over 2 sigma x, then of course u squared is equal to e to the I omega t t sigma x. And so this is rotating twice as fast now. So by taking and decomposing into the rotating and counter-rotating field, we get this piece that rotates twice as fast. And the rotating wave approximation says, let's neglect this. And it is really simple to quantify the errors that you create there by neglecting that. They're always going to be effectively a geometric error that you're tilting your effective field a little bit. I'll explain that in a second. It's going to come in as a ratio of the frequency that you're driving the system at, omega R, compared to omega. And so as you're looking at controlling your qubits, for many systems, this is going to be a part in a thousand to a couple parts in a thousand. And if you're saying that you're controlling your qubits to five nines so that you can run quantum error correction, then you're going to have to come back and look at this. But we'll neglect it for now because it makes the physics really easy to calculate. And then later on, it is, of course, trivial to go back and put in. It just makes things a little bit more tedious to calculate. Okay. So now then we go back to saying that the Liouville von Neumann equation in the time-dependent, the rotating frame, and this is the so-called effective field. And so if we take our term and say that this is omega over 2 sigma z, and I subtract omega t over 2 sigma z, and this is going to be some smaller frequency. So omega t, so omega from the internal Hamiltonian, that's the energy difference of the qubit states. Omega T is the energy of the drive field. That's typically some piece of electronics in your lab. So it's going to be a frequency set in a synthesizer. And this should be fairly precise because it's one frequency. You set it in your lab. You controlled it with a knob. This one, your qubit is going to vary given a lot of different environmental parameters. So it's too much of a fiction to set those two to be exactly the same because we expect the qubit frequency to vary a little bit. So we're saying delta omega is very small compared to omega. And it's also going to be small compared to omega RF. Okay. But we don't want it to be zero. And I need to add into both of these. So I'm going to write that down here. I need to add omega RF sigma x over 4. So this piece is the amplitude of the control signal. So if you had a radio, this is the station you're tuned to. And that's how loud your radio is. And you get this factor of 4 because of the rotating and counter-rotating components. And then from this moment on, the norm in the community is to forget that factor of four and renormalize it to two, and say that the frequency, that the amplitude you want to control to, is the amplitude that your qubit sees, not the amplitude that you've set on your device. So then we'll rewrite this as omega RF sigma X over 2. So, we have our qubit states, we have some piece delta omega, we have some field omega RF, and of course this is the effective field. And you know, qubits are always trivial. All they do is rotate around the effective field. So the only action, if you started off in this state, would be to rotate about that effective field. Okay. Now, it's not enough if you have a qubit to say what the Hamiltonian is. Because if we only had unitary dynamics, then we would have a quantum computer already. What we need to do is to say what the noise is and how the noise is going to influence our ability to control. And so we need to add some noise. And the when the early papers in magnetic resonance were published, they were published simultaneously by two groups. The first paper actually came out of Holland during World War II, where Goethe's lab developed all of the necessary ideas and instrumentation to do magnetic resonance. But unfortunately, Holland during the war was a lousy place to actually do experiments, and so he couldn't get them to work. And Goethe published a series of beautiful, beautiful papers, starting off with his title with Failure to See, and then stick in your favorite Nobel Prize from the 60s. So magnetic resonance, ESR, the Mossbauer effects, all of this he had figured out. But of course, in the United States, after World War II, it was a great place to do experiments because, you know, you could go down to your local radio shop and you could buy everything you needed for an experiment from the war surplus. And so there were two groups, Ed Purcell and Felix Bloch at Harvard and Felix in Stanford, that immediately after the war looked at magnetic resonance. And Felix Bloch, you know, because of the Bloch wave function. So Bloch was one of the early founders of quantum mechanics and very influential in understanding quantum mechanics as applied to solid state systems. And Purcell, you might still use his book in E&M. So he's, a very influential physicist. You certainly has done a lot of work in quantum mechanics. The Purcell effect is, of course, named after him. But mostly you see him in the classical field. But the papers were exactly opposite. Ed Purcell's paper was on a quantum mechanical description of magnetic resonance. And Bloch's paper was on a classical model that contained every feature of the quantum mechanical system. So Bloch was the one who recognized that for a spin 1/2 particle, that there was an isomorphism to O3. And so it wasn't, it's often described as though it's an ad hoc model. There's nothing ad hoc about it. You know, he knew and shows exactly that there's this isomorphism. And since there is this isomorphism, why don't we simply talk about the system in terms of a set of coupled differential equations? So we're going to get there. But we first need to add some noise. And since you've taken Joseph's course, we can think about two different systems. So we have our system, and we said that there's a unique quantization axis. It's along Z. So Z is always going to be special. So we don't need to talk about Z, because the noise in Z is going to lead to a loss of coherence, and only a loss of coherence, okay? Because since it commutes with the eigenstructure, it can never cause a spin flip. But of course, noise about X and about Y can cause spin flips. And there's two extreme models. We can say there's only sigma X noise. And that's a good model if you have a two-dimensional system. So if I have a system that's electrons floating on helium, then the electrons floating on helium screen the noise. There's only one axis of noise that you're allowed. If I have a superconductor as a thin film device, the same thing, that you have a planar geometry. And so if I have sigma X noise, then we can describe it in terms of a set of Krauss operators. That says, hey, by and large, nothing happens. But occasionally, with some probability P, we do get a sigma X, we get a bit flip. And of course, if I have sigma X and sigma Y noise, then I need to have to treat those two equivalently. Like so. So let's see what happens if I have these. Well, if I have the X operator and I apply this Krauss map, then of course, if I apply this element to the Krauss map, I return X. If I apply this element to the Krauss map, I return X. And so then at the end of the day, I return X. Of course, if I look at how this acts on Y, then I find that Y is reduced by an amplitude of 1 minus 2P, and the same thing as Z. So let's see what happens here. So if I have X-only noise, and I have my system in the lab frame, because these models are described in the lab frame. When I described the reason I would want to have a sigma X noise, I had to say, oh, I've got this two-dimensional geometry. And we're saying, oh, we only have noise here. There's our noise. There's two ways you can see this. The way I like is to say, ah, I know that if I have a coherence in the lab frame, that the coherence is going to be rotating. It'll rotate with this frequency omega. And therefore, half the time, this noise can't act on the system. Okay? And we'll contrast that to XY noise. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you mean that the noise is acting only one half of the XY plane?
I mean that it's only along this axis. Okay? So the noise here looks like I have a Hamiltonian, which is some noise frequency of time along sigma x. Whereas here, I've got a Hamiltonian which has independent noise along x and y, and they're the same amplitude. And of course, if we write down a Krauss operator, then we're saying explicitly that we're looking at a stochastic process, that every event is independent of the prior events. Okay? Right, so I'm assuming you had all that with Joe, that, you know, this is just says this is an infinitesimal model of the action. Yeah. So here, of course, with the same processing spin, you see the noise all the time. So that for the loss of coherence, this one is more important. That's not surprising. But of course, if I have a vector along z, this is always important. And both of these are always important. So the result is that in this case, the time to lose coherence is limited the time to polarize your sample. And here, the time to lose coherence is limited by the time it takes to polarize your sample. And I want to write down for you the block equations, and then I'm going to come back to this. So the block equations combine all of this physics, and they do it in terms of the expectation values of a spin one-half particle. So the first piece we see is that the Hamiltonian is going to lead to a precession. So sigma x is going to be omega, delta omega in this case, sigma y, and it's going to be delta omega, sigma y, and we always have to think, I've got x goes into y, so that's negative. And of course, because the operator is about z, this is zero. So this is the precession. Then we have. Oh, no, no, just. Thank you. So then we have this term, which is going to cause a rotation about z, about x, but it's going to couple y and z. So we'll have a term that is omega 1 sigma z, omega 1 sigma y, and x takes z into minus y. So it looks like that. And then we have the piece that says, oh, we have to lose coherence because we have noise. And there's a rate of loss given here. And so if I took that probability as being proportional to time and I integrated, I would get a time constant, and that time constant we call T2. And of course, there's a separate time constant for losing, or, well, for losing our correlations along the z-axis. And of course, the time constant for the dephasing simply says, oh, I have a bunch of quantum systems, they look the same, there's a time over which they're distinguishable. The time constant here says, I have a time that it takes for the system to interact with the environment and learn the temperature of the environment and readjust its populations to be with it, be in equilibrium with the temperature of the environment. So the T1 time requires that there's an energy flow from the system to the environment. Okay? And then we say that we should have a return to some equilibrium state. And of course, that equilibrium state is going to be given by, here we have a two-level system. So our spin 0 and 1 are qubits. And so the equilibrium state, the population in 0 divided by the population 1 is e to the minus the energy, h bar omega, and of course, Boltzmann's constant and temperature. Right? So that's just the population ratios of those two states. Yeah? So we know where we should end up, given that if we knew the temperature. Okay. There's Bloch's equations. Now we need to say, over here, we see that we have this noise process, but the noise process is along one axis, and so it's working half the time. Over here, we have a noise process that acts all the time. And we need to put a bound on these rates, because I can't allow thermally the system to polarize. So if I take a vector, let's say I have a coherence here. So it's along y, say. Doesn't make any bloody difference. And of course, I could achieve that by taking my state and applying a unitary transform to rotate the state from z to y. So with a simple unitary, I can create this coherence. Now imagine that T1 is short compared to T2. Well, if T1 says that I'm going to have the expectation value of sigma z is going to be 1 minus e to the minus t over T1 times the equilibrium value of the magnetization, right? Just integrating that line of Bloch's equations. So if T1 is short and T2 is long, then the vector is going to stay there in the rotating frame. But I'm going to grow the vector in this direction so that my resultant state vector would be longer. And by a simple unitary rotation, I'd be able to change the length of my vector. I could polarize the system simply by going and giving it lots of pulses. And that would be great. Well, be great for some activities. But of course, it violates physics, right? So we don't allow this. So T2 must be less than T1 for XY noise. And T2 must be less than twice T1 for X or Y noise. And so when you look at the literature involving spin qubits, you see this really strong statement. T2 is always less than T1. And then you go to the qubit community with the planar structure, and you find out that, you can easily violate that. It comes just from where the noise is. Okay. Now, there's one more piece that we're going to add, and then I wanted to start talking about how we find all of these. I told you that I didn't want to set delta omega to be zero because it's a parameter which depends too much on the environment. And so delta omega, we're going to end up having some classical probability distribution of delta omega, and it will be centered about whatever it is. Be nice to be Gaussian. Now, we showed you in the neutron case that it can be very far from Gaussian, right? That it can have this strange shape that was shown up in the momentum distribution. Okay. And so we're going to have to worry about that, too. So let's ask. Someone comes, they give you a qubit, they say, look, I have this qubit, it's a great qubit. You should make a quantum computer out of it. And now your task is to say, I need to find at least those parameters, right? Yeah. I'm glad you asked the question. That's just me moving between nomenclatures without paying any attention. So let's talk about the experiments that we do. The first experiment is named after Rabi, called a Rabi fringe. And all the experiments typically look like some time course of events. And the first piece says, prepare the qubit state It depends upon whose qubit we're using. For some qubits, this simply says, wait, that there's nothing you have to do. It'll become to some thermal state, as described by the Boltzmann equation. For others, you have to actually cool, or perhaps you need to post-select on something. So we'll look at that. But anyways, abstractly, we're just going to say, prepare a qubit. And then here, along this axis, we're saying that this is omega RF, and there's some time that we apply that for. And so we'll have our Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian, of course, won't have that term. And then at some instant, we turn it on, leave it on for some time. And at the end, we measure. And typically, we'll think about measuring in the eigenbasis of the qubit. Okay. So if we take, for an instance, delta omega equals zero, then the process is trivial. The spin is going to nutate. It'll nutate at a rate given by omega RF. And so if I looked at the angle that this was going to evolve in, that angle theta is equal to omega RF times the time of that action. And so if we're making a measurement of the zero state, then I should see a set of fringes. Okay. Typically, we report it as a measurement of the expectation value of sigma z. And so then we see a cosine oscillation. Yeah?
In which plane is this mutation happening?
So this is if I'm rotating about x, then it's happening in the yz plane. Because our qubit started off along the z-axis. Okay? And so from this fringe in time, we can get, of course, the frequency. But let's ask a more interesting question. We've got the relaxation times here. And so what is the effective relaxation time we see under the action of a Rabi field? Well, when it's along z, then it's going to decay as t1. When it's along y, it's going to decay as t2. And so the rate of decay, so 1 over t Rabi, is going to be half the time it's evolving, it's losing amplitude is t1, half the time it's losing amplitude is t2, so that t Rabi is this. So if we measure the fringes, then out of the fringes, we get the amplitude of the control field. We get a bound on the relaxation times of the qubit. So the more fringes, the better. And the last thing is, what happens if delta omega is not zero? Well, if delta omega is not zero, then we're tilted out of this frame. And of course, now we're going to process, we're going to nutate, sorry, about that axis. And the rate that we process at is the vector sum of the two frequencies, right? And so if I have a dispersion of these, then I'll see that I have a loss of coherence in, or loss of the visit, or the fringe visibility. And so I'll get to decay. And so this also gives us indirectly a bound on how big our noise is associated with delta omega. Okay? So I wanted to get a little bit further, but we'll do that tomorrow. So the idea then is to say, okay, take our qubit, and even with this simple qubit, let's go and learn enough about it that we can start to control it. Any questions? Okay, then we'll continue tomorrow.